I have directed Secretary Connally to suspend temporarily the convertibility of the dollar into gold or other reserve assets.
Where is the gold?
This is the Gold News Hour podcast. Fergus Hodgson, your host. Thank you for tuning in, everybody. It's my pleasure to do these, and I'm so glad you're with us. If you want more precious metals, economic freedom, mining, please do go to goldnewsletter.com/podcast and subscribe. Also, you can subscribe to our newsletters at goldnewsletter.com. We have a guest who was on the show years ago now, but I'm so glad we have him back, Avi Gilbert. He is the founder of ElliottWaveTrader.net. This is a live trading room in the forum focusing on Elliott Wave market analysis. So he's a chartist or a technical analyst, and his goal is to remove personal bias or predisposition, which is fascinating to me. So Avi, we're going to drill down into what this Elliott Wave trading process is and defend technical analysis, because I'm glad to have that perspective. Welcome to the show, and tell us, how did you become a believer in the Elliott Wave method?
Thank you very much for having me. For those that don't know my background, I am formerly an accountant. I have an accounting major, an economics major. So I know accounting and economics extraordinarily well. I then got a law degree and then a master's of law. I went to NYU for a master's of law in taxation. And I was a partner, national director at a very large accounting firm. So, look, I understood business. I understood accounting. I understood law. And I understood how to take apart a balance sheet and how businesses work. And then when I tried to apply that to the investing world, I was pretty average. And I really understood how businesses are valued, probably more so than anybody else out there, most people out there with my background. And I was at best average at investing. So I started looking for other reasons. Why? What am I missing here? And I stumbled upon some work regarding market sentiment and how market sentiment affects, you know, the large markets and large companies. And I started, you know, delving into that, and it led me to Elliott Wave analysis, which is exactly what it does. It tracks market sentiment, and whereas fundamentals are often lagging at the market turns, usually Elliott Wave analysis, which tracks market sentiment, gives you strong forewarning of a turn that's about to occur. So it gives you a leg up on the market, shall we say.
Yeah. Do you want to clarify what this sentiment is? Because maybe you touched on it just briefly, but is this basically the gap between fundamentals and the actual prevailing market price?
I'll give you an example. I've heard so many times, you know, let's say the market is rallying strongly and the fundamentals aren't good, or it comes out, the market starts rallying after a negative fundamentals report comes out. People often scratch their head and wonder why. Well, it's sentiment that's driving the market or the specific stock, not the fundamentals. And we see it so often, yet people just shrug it off and then they just move on to the next. What's the next news that's going to come out that's going to move the market? But they shrug off every time where it doesn't make sense to them. I was refusing to allow myself to shrug it off. I look for intellectual honesty in everything I do. So why should I shrug something off that just wasn't jiving with the way I'm supposed to look at the market? And that's, again, it's what led me to understanding market sentiment. What it really means, and in the most simplistic terms, this is the most simplistic terms. When a market gets too bullish, I don't care if the sentimentals are amazing, and I'm sorry, the fundamentals are amazing. You often see fundamentals the best at market highs. But when the market gets too bullish, there's nobody left to be pushing the market higher. Everybody that wants to be in is in. So there's only one direction the market's going to go. It's going to turn down. Same thing at extreme bearishness. When the market hits an extreme bearish point, there's no, everybody that's wanted to sell has sold, and there's only one point left for the market to go. And, you know, in fact, we saw that not long ago, October 13th, when that really negative CPI report came out, and everybody expected the market to tank from it. Well, we were looking at that as a final flush down and about to start a major rally. And that's exactly what happened. We're about 10% higher than the point the market hit that low. And it was purely because we hit a negative sentiment extreme, and the market was telling us it's about to turn back up.
Okay. I'm not sure I understood all that, to be frank. Do you want to try to be more succinct with listeners who got lost there in terms of just what you mean by sentiment?
Effectively, it means mass mood. The mood of the public as a whole will affect the way the market looks at news or fundamentals. For example, if you are in a very, very negative sentiment trend, if the trend itself is in a negative sentiment trend, meaning the market is moving down and it still has further to go based upon our analysis and calculations, if you have a positive report that comes out to the market, market's likely going to interpret that based upon where it is in its negative sentiment trend. So if there's further to go in that negative sentiment trend, you can bring a positive news report or positive fundamental to the market. It won't make a difference. The market will just interpret that negatively and still keep moving down. The same thing on the positive side. If the market is in a positive sentiment trend and a negative news item or fundamental gets reported, market's going to ignore it and just keep on going in its positive trend. So I'm hoping that explains it a little better. And we've all seen times like that when that happens.
You're trying to drill down to this human psyche, which does have a herd mentality to it. And often it defies comprehension, right? It doesn't make a lot of sense. And so you're trying to drill down into this and at the same time remove your own biases. Okay.
I'll give you another example. If you remember back in, I think it was around 2012, 2013, where the Fed started putting out more and more QE, quantitative easing. And of course, what was the expectation of the entire market at the time? Oh, quantitative easing is coming out. Gold is going to the moon. Well, I'll tell you, at the time, we weren't saying gold is going to the moon because we recognized that gold was in a negative sentiment trend, and we expected it to drop down towards the 1,000 region, which is exactly what happened, no matter how much quantitative easing was thrown at the market. People were shocked that gold kept going down, because gold was in a negative sentiment trend. And no matter what you're going to throw at it from a fundamental perspective, it didn't matter. That was probably a perfect example for it.
Yeah, it does seem that the precious metals, since as opposed to the base or industrial metals, they must be incredibly responsive to sentiment. So that's where your work is most relevant. Let's say the beauty pageant stocks, which are the stocks that are most, let's say, broad-based in terms of their appeal, their more populist appeal. Do you want to clarify which investment vehicles are most sensitive to sentiment?
Excellent, excellent question. It's all based upon a continuum. The greater the mass involvement in a particular product, the greater mass sentiment will direct how that product moves. So you look at it as on a continuum. For example, the S&P 500, that is predominantly driven by sentiment. The massive mega cap, those are predominantly driven by sentiment. But then if you go down to the other side of the continuum, you'll have something like a micro cap biotech stock. Sentiment is going to be meaningless for that stock. That stock is going to be driven by the one product that micro cap has in its production line. So there's a continuum there. The further you go along to the masses being, you know, what's involved in that product, like I said, mega caps and the S&P 500, the more likely sentiment is going to be the primary driver of that product.
Let's say we agree that there is this mass sentiment or herd mentality. And as you say, I tend to agree with you, it's much more prevalent in vehicles or stocks that are broadly held, that are subject to this kind of this mass psychology, fine. Is it correct to say that technical analysis or study of mass psychology is poo-pooed in the financial academic world?
Of course it is. Anything that is really not understood to its core is poo-pooed. And, you know, if you are an academician, you know, that is the be-all, end-all of your world when it comes to investing. If you're somebody who's going to maintain more of an open mind and broader perspective of how markets work, and in truth, over the last 30 years, more and more studies have been presenting how much more important the whole sentiment side of the market is, the psychology side of the market is. Unfortunately, the academic world has not caught up with that. And, you know, just as I mentioned to you before, I've written articles that the academic world should not be throwing stones. There have been many times where it itself has gone back and said, we have completely failed. Literally, we have completely failed. And one of the examples was back in 2000, the market top in 2000. You know, ultimately, you know, I'll give you some quotes. For example, Paul Samuelson, the co-founder of Modern Economics, he noted, and I'll quote to you, we are at a loss for words. If nothing else, this baffling economy has defeated the vocabulary of economics. And I mean, I can give you more and more, but what I'll probably end with to explain to you this whole perspective, Eugene Fama, father of the efficient market hypothesis, told the New Yorker in January of 2010, and I'm going to quote to you, I'd love to know more about what causes business cycles. I used to do macroeconomics, but I gave up long ago. Economics is not very good at explaining swings in economic activity. We don't know what causes recession. We've never known. That's a quote from the father of the efficient market hypothesis. So, you know, academicians really, you know, as I've done more and more research into this, I've realized, why don't academicians move from the efficient market hypothesis? It's still taught as the primary basis for economic theory in colleges today. Why haven't they moved? Well, from my research, it seems they're all pretty much in agreement. They don't have anything better.
The Gold Newsletter is proudly sponsored by Inventa Capital Corporation, a venture capital advisory firm dedicated to the acquisition and development of assets in the natural resource sector. Today, Inventa is one of the premier mining groups with a first-rate portfolio of companies and a world-class team.
This is the Inventa Capital Update, and we have with us Cherie Leadon. She's the chief executive of Gold Bull Resources, that is goldbull.ca. On the TSX feed, the ticker is GBRC, and over the counter for Americans, it's GBRCF. They have a market cap of around 5 million US, 6 million Canadian. And there is some news from Gold Bull Resources. They have a PEA, preliminary economic assessment, which came out at the end of October, so very recently. And this is exploring the prospect of converting this into an above the water table mine, but I don't want to put words into Sheree's mouth. So Cherie, do you want to give us the highlights of this latest report?
Yeah, sure. So this is the first time that we've looked at the economics of our existing resource at Sam. And we've always previously been talking about the exploration upside and potential. Essentially, the more we drill, the more ounces we can define at the project. But given the exploration sector has really slowed down, we decided to look at the economics of our existing resource to see, you know, that does it make sense to start up a small scale operation based on the current resource? And we looked at 250,000 ounces of our 500,000 ounce resource, and they're the ounces that are located above the water table, so completely dry. And what that means in Nevada is it can allow for a much quicker permitting process if you stay entirely above the water table. So that was the reasoning for only looking at half the ounces that we've got at the moment.
Can you do the permitting simultaneously where you get, let's say, the above the water table approved and you can get started on that while the other permitting is going through the process?
Yeah, absolutely. So I mean, even above the water table, permitting takes about 1 year for baseline studies and then say 6 to 9 months for the actual permit. So it's still, you know, almost a 2 year process staying above the water table. And when you go below it, it just requires more baseline studies and more hydrogeological investigations. And that, you know, adds another year or so onto it. So there's no reason why that can't be done whilst you're in production above the water table.
And there's a heck of a lot of meat in this report. So I was looking over it. It's about 120 pages. And this is where I'm hoping you'll make it easier for us to understand. Now, one data point that stuck out to me was this one-year payback rate, which obviously is, or payback period, is enticing. Do you want to clarify what that means?
Yeah, sure. So basically, we looked at a small-scale gold mining operation, very conventional stock standard heap leach processing of 35,000 ounces per annum. So our mine would produce 35,000 ounces per annum each year. And to build that mine, it's going to cost about $28 million. And the number that you put out, we're going to pay that back in just over a year. So it's a very rapid payback period. And it produced an IRR of 99%, so almost 100% investor rate of return. And on top of that, an NPV of US $77 million. And you mentioned our market cap of being less than $7 million. So there's a massive disconnect between the value of this project and our current market cap at the moment.
It's insane. And so then this seems like it does seem like a no-brainer to do this. So are we just all full steam ahead?
Yeah, so I'd say we're steam ahead. We're not full steam ahead, but we're steam ahead. We just had a board meeting and we decided to commence the long lead items. So there's certain aspects to permitting that just take time. They're not expensive, but they take time. So for example, water monitoring, you've got to monitor the water at four quarters. Even if we're above the water table, we've got to prove the negative. So we're going to start that in quarter one to essentially say we've got four quarters of data that show that there is no water in these holes. So then we've got tick that box. So that's actually probably the longest lead. There's some things like your flower surveys. You've got to survey them when they're blooming and things like that. So we're very cognizant of what needs to be done and we take permitting seriously, but we know the things that are going to take time. So we're going to start them now so that we can come to a decision point and then we're ready to go rather than have to do all those long lead permitting aspects. You know, a year from now, we're going to start now. So we're ready to run.
Mm, and although you're an explorer, you're proceeding, like you said, a little bit off your initial plan, but just given the circumstances, that's what you see as the best option. Do you want to clarify the financing plans to get to this $28 million?
So at the moment, as a PEA, we haven't done a deep dive into the financing. That will come during the PFS or the feasibility study, well, of which we're going to start. We're going to commence aspects essentially immediately, such as these long lead items. The PEA also identified that we needed some more metallurgical work. So that's another aspect that will be done in the feasibility study. And financing these days, post feasibility study, it's not unusual to have up to 70% debt. And the remainder, circa 30% equity. There's also other mechanisms, whether it's a royalty or whether it's a percentage of the project. But we're looking at all options. And we're, at the moment, the next step is essentially we've got enough cash in the bank to commence these long lead items immediately. We've got about $2 million cash in the bank. We've got another US $750,000 sitting in a bond account. So we're not come raise, and we do have adequate cash to keep advancing these assets. So just serious bargain territory at the current prices. We've got supportive major shareholders who are fully supportive of us investigating this near-term cash flow scenario of the advancing the project. And although the market hasn't really reacted as we had hoped, we're getting the attention of a number of gold producers and bigger companies that are essentially looking at our project now and requesting CAs and site visits to see, what is this project that could be producing such cash flow and have such an incredible IRR?
Yeah, and as you said, the financing is a lot more forthcoming for production than for exploration. So the financing is unlikely to be a hurdle.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think so, but it's, you know, that's why we changed tax. You know, before it was all about let's add more ounces via in-ground exploration at Sandman. And the sad fact is we announced some phenomenal gold results earlier this year and our share price went down. Essentially, we'd announced good results, share price would go down. So the more money we were spending on drilling and exploration, you know, the less the company was valued at. So it didn't make a lot of sense, but we've also had to be realistic and say, well, we can't keep drilling. You know, with the money we've got in the bank, what's the point of continuing to drill and add more ounces when the market isn't rewarding that? So we believe that we've got a better chance at a re-rating via essentially looking at the feasibility study and looking at the economics of extracting this gold that is literally sticking out of the ground.
Yeah, folks, if you want to learn more, it's goldbull.ca. That's the website. And you can follow them on Twitter at goldbullGBRC. So that's the ticker, GBRC on the Toronto Venture Exchange and GBRCF over the counter. And otherwise, Sheree, obviously, I'm so glad to learn of this update. Thank you for your time.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
Well, yes and no, because these days, and I've written about this, the efficient market hypothesis has evolved in terms of the way it's taught on the campus, that there's the weak, semi-strong, and strong. So they try to delineate and make it more of a spectrum. And it's more of a theoretical framework than an absolute.
I said the underlying assumptions still are not workable in the modern and real world as to how markets move.
Sure. And so I wonder though whether the behavioral finance wing of the field will venture more into what you explore, what this market sentiment or broader sentiment. Now let's say we assume or we agree with you that there is this herd mentality or herd behavior. How does one go about disentangling this? Like you said, that the academics don't seem to have a handle on it and largely see it as a black box almost. What have you done in your own career? And what is this Elliott Wave method in terms of disentangling the human herd behavior?
Well, I'll start with explaining Elliott Wave a little bit. Back in the 1930s, Ralph Nelson Elliott started studying the market, an accountant also. And what he identified was that the market was fractal in nature, meaning it was variably self-similar at varying degrees of trend. So what does that mean? It means the market had a certain pattern to it as to how it moved up, how it moved back. And when he took Fibonacci mathematics and used and overlaid that into his discovery of the fractal nature of the market, he was able to start identifying market turning points rather accurately. As an example, when World War II was raging around him, Elliott was calling for a 70 plus year bull market. Now, when you take a step back and you realize World War II is raging around you, it is the most negative of sentiment times potentially in history. In our recent history, and he was calling for a 70-year plus bull market. So basically, after learning Elliott a bit more, over the last 20, 30 years, we've been seeing more and more studies that have been focusing on the psychological side of the market. And what they've been showing is that not only can the market exist and move outside of exogenous factors, and there have been many studies that show that exogenous factors do not move the market in the same manner people believe, but there's a pattern to the market, and there's a way it moves. More so, there's also a mathematical movement that's inherent in the market. For example, nature is guided through Fibonacci mathematics. There is much of what we see in the ratios that grow throughout nature that is based upon ratios based upon Fibonacci mathematics. Over the last 20, 30 years, the studies have started moving towards, well, do human beings think? based upon these same type of ratios. And the studies have concluded that not only in moths do we see people making decision-making based upon these Fibonacci ratios, we even see it on an individual basis. And when you take all of these things and you put them together, it really gives you a tremendous port for understanding how the markets can move in a similar way.
Okay. And well, your website is ElliottWaveTrader.net. And how do people, I mean, I'm trying to think, my concern would be that much of the sentiment happens in real time, right? So how can people engage with the right information?
Well, effectively, we provide real-time analysis. We do analysis based upon 5-minute charts, 60-minute charts, daily charts, weekly, month. We provide, you know, we're looking at it on multiple time frames. And, you know, during the day, we're doing work based upon 5- and 60-minute charts, even some 8-minute charts. So we are actually tracking this in real time on an ongoing basis. As I said to you just on October 13th, when everybody thought the market was about to take a very strong drop, people were saying as much as 5% were going to be down. We were looking at in real time, and I literally, as we were hitting the lows, I put out a note to our members, and I said, this should be the final last gasp down before we turn up strongly. We track this in real time. Now, am I going to say that we are 100% accurate? Of course. But I could say that people have been quite shocked at the accuracy with which we've been able to identify market turns utilizing this methodology.
Okay. And this is the Gold Newsletter podcast. So we take a particular interest in the metals and gold and silver, maybe more than others. But a big topic this year has been the way that the dollar has performed so, let's say, well, despite having high inflation. And so gold has basically held its ground in other currencies and actually gained ground against some. But versus the dollar, it has struggled. It's actually down about 13% this last 6 months and about 7% this year. When can we expect, or how would we identify when that might turn, that sentiment might turn? We might get back onto the past trajectory.
Well, interestingly, on the dollar, I'm looking for a breakdown, a sustained break of the 109 region on the Dixie. Tell me that we're probably going to be in at least 12 to 18 month pullback on the Dixie. So we're right at that support for the Dixie right now. So I'm looking around that 109 region as the main support. With regard to the metals, oftentimes we'll use a lot of the common ETFs, because more people will utilize the ETFs more so than the actual
GLD ETF.
Right. Correct. But here's the problem. I would not suggest anybody invest long term in the GLD. As a lawyer, I've actually taken apart the prospectus, and I did a full webinar on the GLD prospectus that they could find in the library of our website. It's free. They can get onto there and hear that. There's no charge for them to see that, but it should be in the public site of our website that they could see it. But so I wouldn't suggest anybody invest long term in the GLD. If you want to invest long term in gold, you buy gold. But I use the GLD for analysis purposes. And my analysis is saying that until we're able to get, and we use 5-wave structures to tell us the market is now moving into a bullish phase. So until I'm able to get a 5-wave structure off these lows, and I'm expecting a bottoming in this region in both gold and silver as well as GDX, do we have another lower low is the only question I have. But once we see a 5-wave structure moving through the 160-150 to 162 region on the GLD, I'm looking for a run that should be taking us, you know, well into new all-time highs as we look out towards 2023-2024.
It's just so fascinating to me how that you can say that, and I mean I agree with you, but do you want to comment on what the psyche is, or what the sentiment is that has kept us from making that breakout? I mean, maybe that's a cryptic question, but I just look and I think, we discuss this all the time. We think there's inflation, there's geopolitical instability, there's lower confidence in the Federal Reserve, the U.S. federal deficit just seems to be unlimited. And yet there hasn't been that change of heart yet. Do you want to comment, what does it take to make, I mean, you say you just look at the charts, but do you want to go beyond that and just look at the human psyche and what kind of catalyst really is meaningful?
The problem is most people look at a market and believe that an exogenous factor is what is ultimately going to move that market. And as I said, we had one of the most extreme exogenous factors that everybody and their mother and grandmother and grandmother's dog thought was going to send gold to the moon, and that was quantitative easing. Yet gold continued to move down until it completed its correction. And of course, everybody was claiming it was manipulation. It was not manipulation. You know, there are tons of people out there that are claiming, you know, gold and silver are manipulated. Yes, there are cases out there that say that they're manipulated, but people have to understand the difference between what spoofing is and what it takes to move a market, you know, move the silver market down from 45 to 15. And that's not a manipulated move. What happens is gold and silver, just like any other market out there, goes into corrective phases. When we topped out in, when was it? Is it August of 2020? We topped out in August of 2020 in gold, and we have been involved in this basically sideways consolidation in gold. We call this a fourth wave. As I said, markets move in five-way structures. This is a fourth wave consolidation that we've had, and we're looking for a fifth wave to take us to new all-time highs. So effectively, the sentiment structure has been accurately telling us gold is not going to be ready to move upside until it completes its corrective structure.
Okay. And how do you make sure your own personal biases do not creep into your analysis?
I do not follow the news. I do not follow exogenous factors. I do not let exogenous factors affect the mathematics through which I view the markets. My view of markets is based purely on a mathematical perspective. I do not let anything otherwise come in outside of that mathematical perspective.
Okay. Folks, if you want to learn more from Avi, the website is ElliottWaveTrader.net. And Elliot has two T's at the end.
And two L's.
It does too, yeah. and you can follow Avi on Twitter. It's AviGilBurt. And on LinkedIn, we'll have all these links, including links referred to by Avi during the interview, at goldnewsletter.com/podcast. Obviously, there's a great deal to be learned here, and I've just given us an intro there, but please do follow his work, and I will too. Avi, thanks for sharing your time today, and I look forward to next time, okay?
Thank you ever so much.